I hope you all enjoyed the proceedings yesterday. For me, it was quite invigorating and exciting to see the quality of science, the enthusiasm of everyone, and more importantly, I think your sort of collective discussion about the requirements for and the opportunities for collaborations that came from the conversations yesterday. And I think that's going to be certainly a central theme as we go forward. So we have the same format today. We'll have a number of individual speakers as well as several forums that will examine from the perspective of an advocate as well as the scientists themselves certain aspects of the human condition that we want to deal with. For those of you who are social media people, we have the Facebook pages up for One Mind for Research. We already have about 55 fans, and more importantly, we're already getting contributions, so that's a good thing. So get your friends to get on the Facebook page for One Mind for Research. This morning, we're going to begin our conversations with a topic called New Ways to Speed Treatment and Development. This is going to be led by Mark McClellan. Mark is known to many of you, former commissioner of the FDA. His degree list is the entire list of alphabet soup from MDs to MPAs and just about everything else in between. He has a long and distinguished career. He's today the director of the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform and the Leonard D. Schaefer Chair in Health Policy Studies and the head of the Brookings Institution. So he's well known to many of you, works at very high levels and with all the right people to help us become of one mind for research. So please welcome Mark McClellan.
Garen, thanks for that introduction. I'd like to thank Congressman Kennedy, Jonathan, everybody else who's been working so hard to put this tremendous event together. I'm very pleased to be a part of it. There are so many diverse perspectives here and so much potential for synergy for making progress toward on the One Mind goals again, very glad to be a part of all of this. I'm going to talk for a few minutes. My background, as you heard from Garen, is in economics and policy, but as it relates to a lot of medical issues like the ones that are involved in a range of brain diseases. And I want to focus on some of the issues that you all began to bring up yesterday, questions about where to go from here and how to have the most impact on health and cost of these very burdensome brain diseases. I'm going to talk in several parts, first about some of the costs involved and then about some complementary steps to the additional support for research that can make real progress possible. And all this stems from discussions that we've had over past months in putting this effort together, including in no small way Congressman Kennedy's vision about the potential for much more rapid progress on diseases. And in particular, rapid progress on brain diseases is very important because they are so prevalent. This is a chart of lifetime prevalence of a range of common brain diseases, depression, anxiety, substance abuse, Alzheimer's, all very common for the American public. And in the future, those costs, as I'll talk about more, are likely to become even higher. It's not just a question of the incidence of these diseases, but their burden. They are a leading cause of disability and lost productivity. This set of neuropsychiatric illnesses is up there with cardiac disease in terms of estimated number of disability day impacts on the American population, disability and lost productivity. Brain diseases are also a leading driver of health expenditures. Now, I'm not sure that these numbers are ones that you can take as final. They involved us having to draw information from a range of different sources, but what's most impressive is when you put the numbers together for the set of brain diseases, it's really number one in terms of accounting for health and health-related expenditures. That's not just the burden of Alzheimer's disease, the burden of traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress disorder, other illnesses that are becoming more prevalent with more impacted veterans population. It's also the impact of mental illnesses on many other types of healthcare spending, the interaction among these diseases with other types of healthcare spending. So some very big numbers indeed. And the populations who are affected disproportionately by brain disease are ones that are of particular importance to us from a policy standpoint. Veterans, with approximately 31% of troops returning from Iraq and Afghanistan having one of a number of increasingly common brain diseases, with 18 veterans estimated to commit suicide every day, that exceeds the loss of troops in terms of the combat occurrences in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. Children disproportionately affected in terms of the share of medical expenditures related to mental disorders, and Alzheimer's disease and other related neurodegenerative diseases, Parkinson's disease, and the like are becoming more prevalent with the demographic shifts in our population. So as you can see, these illnesses are not only really important from a disease burden standpoint for the U.S. population, and becoming more so, they're also a primary driver of the increasing costs in our healthcare system, especially going forward with the kinds of demographic changes that I just mentioned. The dark blue line in this slide is probably hard to read from where you are, but the dark blue section in this slide is the expenditures on Medicare, Medicaid, other government programs, the new insurance expansions. And as you can see, this is the main driver of overall federal expenditures. In fact, everything else, the light blue stuff on the slide, is getting thinner and thinner over time due to these increasing costs. Yet, despite the challenges that we're facing here, it really is important to have a gathering like this now, because I don't think we're on track to really alter those courses, the course of these diseases substantially in the short term without further effort, like what many of you are undertaking already, and like what can come out of the synergies of a meeting like this. It's not just enough to document that the burden is high and the costs are big and to try to put more research effort behind doing something about it. It's important to think about ways in which that research effort can translate more effectively into an impact on these costs and the impact on health of Americans. And that's where I think we have, frankly, a lot of room for improvement. If you look at some of the treatments that are in development now, many very promising, hundreds of compounds, not just drugs, which I'm going to focus on given the brevity of my remarks, but also medical devices, surgical interventions, other types of interventions, prevention interventions. But so far, a lot of these ideas have not yet translated into an actual impact on the course of these diseases. And many of these treatments are being pursued now, but they fail in development. And success rates are particularly low for brain and neurologic conditions, as this slide shows, one of the lower success bars there, and these are all pretty low, with an average of 11%, is for diseases affecting the central nervous system, particularly the brain. And many of these failures occur after we've been pursuing ideas for quite some time at a considerable cost. For example, for drugs used for many of the neurologic conditions, many of the failures are attributable to lack of efficacy. The treatments don't turn out to pan out to have a benefit when they're actually tested in clinical populations on a large scale. That's about 30% of failure. Also, problems with safety issues, toxicology, clinical safety failures, are another big source of failure. And many of these failures occur late in the process. This chart is, for those of you who are more of the FDA and regulatory wonk types, as you know, there are a number of phases for demonstrating that a new treatment is safe and effective. Phase one, sort of an early stage where you just look for basic safety problems. Phase two is whether the treatment has, in a somewhat larger population, seems to be showing some net benefits. And then phase three are the larger studies to really confirm that the benefit's there and try to detect important safety problems. Registration and approval come after that, when some final safety issues or other regulatory steps may arise. As you can see here, success drops off from all the many treatments that make it into phase one. You've probably talked some already about how difficult it is to even get good ideas into treatment in humans. for all of the treatments that make it to human testing, only about 60% make it to phase two, but then a large number fail beyond that. And this is in a phase where traditionally clinical trials cost in the tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to conduct. And this is a big reason why the development of new treatments is as expensive as it is today, and why I'm saying that if we really want to make progress on these disorders, development science, the efficiency of turning good ideas into treatments that can be reliably, safely, and effectively used by patients is a very important part of making progress on one mind. Even if we get to that point, though, of having treatments that are proven to be effective, that doesn't necessarily translate into an impact on the population. Just to give you a couple of examples, there are many treatments available now that have been proven to be effective for conditions like post-traumatic stress disorder, but commonly those treatments are not available because of access problems or because of matching problems or because of patients having difficulty following through or not even knowing that they should follow through, having difficulty with adherence to needed medications and the like. Many examples of providers not using the most effective and most recent evidence adequately. For example, according to a 2008 survey by the RAND Corporation, only about 53% of returning soldiers with PTSD or depression even sought care for these issues. So just having technologies available doesn't translate into an impact on health. There are also, even for people who get into treatment, there are failures along the way. Many patients who do have PTSD don't adhere to evidence-based treatment recommendations, which include medication and 10 to 12 weekly visits over a four-month period, and that can be due to problems with access to insurance. But many people who are insured, according to some recent surveys, about 50% of the time don't get recommended treatments. So gaps in using treatments effectively is also an important part of the problem. And so what I'd like to emphasize is there are several steps to lower the cost and lower the burden of brain diseases that go along with this greater emphasis on a synergistic approach to the research itself. That includes the development of an accelerated way of turning good ideas into safe and effective and reliable treatments, and then steps to better encourage the effective use of those treatments in people who can benefit. There are three parts of this that I want to spend my last few minutes here talking about: reducing the scientific uncertainty, reducing the regulatory uncertainty, and reducing the economic uncertainty. In terms of scientific uncertainty, clearly this is where a lot of research, basic research and increasingly applied research, is making a big difference now. It's very important in terms of deriving the discovery of new cures, to understand the disease mechanisms involved and to test out new therapies in the lab. But once that happens, there is still a big process of development, of again demonstrating that the treatments can be safely and effectively used in patients, where we are clearly losing a lot of ground, a lot of money, and a lot of time in turning the good ideas into reliable treatments. That's where regulatory science improvements, having a clearer understanding of disease mechanisms and what that means for showing that treatments are effective in particular patients, can make a difference. Where showing that we're understanding disease models so that treatments can be targeted more effectively, the real promise of genomics and many of the other applied sciences could make a big difference. And then economic uncertainty. As I've talked about, the development of these treatments is a very costly and uncertain process, and with uncertainty and concerns on the payment end for these new technologies, that can be a big drag on actually providing the resources needed to pull all of this development process along. And as we face bigger and bigger challenges in financing healthcare, the problems of squeezing down payments or the goals of reducing costs can potentially get in the way of providing the resources needed to bring these treatments along. So solving all those problems together, you really want to make progress on one mind. It's a big combination of problems, but I think they're all related. They all can benefit from the kinds of synergies that are the focus of this meeting. So just a few specific ideas to highlight in the areas of improving development science, regulatory science, and payment reform that can potentially help along the goal of One Mind. First, let me talk about development science. That's accelerating the design and evaluation of new treatments. As we've been hearing during this forum, there are a lot of promising science in development, thanks to the efforts of people in this room and many of their collaborators. But there's still a good deal we don't understand about the causes, the mechanisms of many major brain diseases, and therefore how to treat them or how to predictively treat them more effectively. Again, lots of progress in genomics, proteomics, metabolomics, which can enable the development of safer, more effective, and more personalized care. But in order to get there, more work needs to be done on understanding disease models, being able to put together these different research ideas into a more comprehensive picture of how diseases progress. And this is happening in some of the brain disorders already. Groups like the Parkinson's Action Network, others are collaborating to share the results of studies and to get more of a consensus about the underlying disease models. Why is this important? This can help provide a way of improving that development science that I talked about before and the regulation, the regulatory processes that go along with it. If there is more consensus and a better understanding of how diseases progress and what kinds of treatments may have an impact in different kinds of patients and on the course of their illness and on markers for when those impacts occur, it can make the development process much less costly and more predictable and can support the implementation of much more efficient clinical trials. To give you a couple of examples of this already in the areas of degenerative brain diseases, there is a coalition against major diseases that has come together as a consortium of scientists from industry, academia, government, advocacy organizations, and other groups that's had an initial focus on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and has used data that, again, data is key, as you all have talked about before, and as Congressman Kennedy has always emphasized, from a range of different studies that has enabled putting together a more complete model of disease progression. If you can collect data on more and more patients, hundreds of patients, thousands of patients, linked to neuroimaging information, linked to information on potential markers of disease progression, CNS fluid study results, things like that, you have the makings of a better empirical model of disease progression. And this matters for development science in that by working with groups like the FDA scientists on using these data to describe how diseases progress and how complication rates occur and the timing of all of that in particular kinds of patients, you can work more closely with the regulatory agency, with the FDA, on designing a clinical trial that the regulators as well as the product developers have confidence in and have a much faster path potentially to get to a successful result in the development process. So a number of examples like this in other areas that are coming together now, and this is, I think, a big, pretty fundamental trend in doing development science, that it's not just a matter of one lab or one company looking at their own results, but rather in a more of a pre-competitive way, putting together the evidence needed to develop better models that everybody can then use to design their clinical trials more efficiently, to know with more confidence earlier on when patients are responding. It's been a big challenge in many of the neurologic diseases and diseases like Alzheimer's, for example. Traditionally, the way that clinical studies have been conducted is to look for an impact on a qualitative analysis of cognitive function in patients who are treated. Well, that tends to occur very late in the process. If we have better validated predictors of when patients are progressing towards cognitive impairment, for example, from neuroimaging, as I was talking about before, or other metabolomic or proteomic studies, then the timing for those trials could be reduced substantially. Instead of waiting years for the final cognitive impairment to occur, the earlier markers could give a clear indication of which treatments really are leading to responses. But you're not going to get there unless you pool the experience of different companies and different labs working together in areas related to clinical neuroscience. So that's the kind of idea behind these coalitions to provide a better model for diseases, better markers for when disease for which patients are at risk for progression and how they are progressing and how new treatments can potentially impact the progression of disease. Along with that, FDA is trying to take some steps to promote more regulatory science. This has been a big priority for previous FDA commissioners like me, and Andy von Eschenbach's here too, and Peggy Hamburg as well. But again, it's not something that FDA can do by itself. It requires the data, the evidence, ideally pooled together, a synergistic effort across the different labs and companies that are working in these areas. But there are examples of these kinds of collaborations taking place now. In a different area, I've been working with an effort on the critical path to TB drug regimens, which is multiple companies sharing data with shared IP arrangements and a lot of collaboration with the regulators involved here in the U.S. and worldwide with the goal of developing a new set of drugs for treating TB, something we haven't had in more than 50 years. And that effort is beginning to show some real payoff. So this kind of thing can be done, and there's some good foundations for doing it already in the neurosciences. Also, collaborative efforts on answering questions that can't easily be answered before treatments are approved. The FDA has started a Sentinel initiative that involves sharing data with a number of different healthcare organizations that have electronic record systems, with a number of health plans that are tracking which medications their patients are using and what kinds of complications are occurring or which kinds of complications are avoided. By doing this in a consistent way, using consistent models of data and disease progression, they are hoping to be able to answer a lot of questions about rare safety problems and other issues that could otherwise hold up the development and hold up the more widespread use of potentially effective treatments. Again, reducing uncertainty through collaboration, through these kinds of synergies. I wanted to spend a few minutes before concluding talking about an issue that often doesn't get that much attention directly in efforts focused on research and development, that I think should get plenty of attention, and that's the set of reimbursement issues. I remember that with the level of uncertainty that I was talking about earlier in developing new treatments, with the cost of developing those treatments without better disease models and so forth, today we're looking at a very expensive and uncertain pathway for bringing new treatments to patients. Now, I've already talked about some ways to reduce some of those costs through making the development process more efficient, through better disease models and more effective collaborations around development and regulatory science. But it's also important, especially in an era of increasingly scarce resources and rising healthcare costs, to find ways to target the money that we are spending on healthcare in a way that really promotes innovation in the treatments themselves and innovation in ways to help promote the effective use of these treatments. As I talked about earlier, our track record right now for using treatments for neurologic diseases, for brain diseases effectively, is not so great. Huge gaps in access to care, adherence, and effective use of technologies. One of the things that's taking place right now in conjunction with these other reforms, and again, just to put another key issue on the table, is changing the way that reimbursement works away from focusing more on paying more when patients have used more technologies and have more complications, and instead putting more of a focus on payments that increase when patients actually get better results, when there's more of an impact on the performance of the technologies for actually improving patient care. This is being done in a lot of areas of payment reform now. Some of you probably heard of ACOs, accountable care organizations, and a lot of other performance-based payment reforms that involve tracking meaningful patient outcomes. In the case of some of these brain diseases, these would include outcomes like patients' mood and other measures of patient experience for associated with neurologic diseases. I showed you earlier, neurologic diseases are up there at the top of the list in this country of conditions that have an impact on the functional status of patients and on the lives of the people around them. We are increasingly doing a better job of being able to measure those kinds of patient experiences. We're doing it in other disease areas. We can do it for brain diseases as well. Then the payment reforms would involve tying some reimbursement, not to just whether or not a new drug is given or whether or not an imaging procedure is performed for a patient with a brain disease, but rather tying some of the payment to what actually happens to that patient, put the bigger emphasis on results, on functional outcomes. And in areas where these reforms have been tried, you see a shift in the way that care is delivered. Some of it's not high tech. Some of it may be as simple as increasing office hours at certain times for certain kinds of patients, or spending money to support nurse practitioners to do outreach to patients with chronic diseases who are having trouble adhering to their medications. But it does put a bigger emphasis on what really works in delivering better results. And that's very important for these brain diseases where the cost of the rates of failure are high, the costs of development are high to begin with, and we need to be putting as much resources as possible into letting product developers know and letting people who are involved in delivering care know that if they do take steps to innovate in a way that actually gets better results to patients, the payoff is going to be there. This is the exact opposite of what we traditionally tend to do in our healthcare financing policies. When costs go up and we can't find a better solution, we try to squeeze the prices down all the way across the board, pay less to physicians in Medicare and the like. That's not a solution for getting the best innovative treatments to patients delivered in the most effective way possible. We need to put the emphasis on measuring results. And the other advantage of this kind of approach is that it develops more of the data, more of the evidence that's needed to really figure out what works. And that's kind of my last point, that we can learn a lot more from the delivery of care with systems like this. Not only by learning more about post-market safety problems, if we're actually tracking functional measures of impact on diseases in broader ranges of patients, but also conducting trials potentially more efficiently as well on a larger scale and on a more routine basis. If we're getting information on functional outcomes for patients, if we're tying the payments that that the providers, that the manufacturers are getting for their treatments more to impact on health, that's going to be a big pull to developing and using the treatments for brain diseases much more effectively. So I've tried to cover a range of areas here in just a few minutes related to turning the goal of One Mind into a reliable, consistent, much more efficient reality for patients. This is an urgent challenge. I want to commend all of you for your efforts, not just today, but efforts throughout your careers and throughout the work, the passion that you have for solving these problems of the One Mind challenge. But I want to encourage you to think about these issues about improving the development process, improving the regulatory process, and providing much stronger financial support, much stronger incentives for getting these effective treatments to patients. I think those are essential parts of the success of One Mind. Thank you all very much for the opportunity to join you this morning. Thank you. I think we might have time for a question or two if anybody has any this early in the morning. Yes, go ahead. Yeah, it's a good question. The question was, for those of you who may not have heard it, are there actual examples of manufacturers being reimbursed, not just based on the volume of pills or the volume of sales they have, but on whether the treatments actually have an impact? There are a number of examples of this now. They haven't yet come very much to neurologic diseases, I think because we aren't reliably getting the performance measures that we should be getting to put the emphasis on actually improving care for patients in neurologic diseases so much. But just to give you one example, Procter & Gamble makes a drug called Actonil that's used to prevent thin bones, prevent osteoarthritis, hip fractures, and that sort of problem. In some of their contracts with insurers in parts of the U.S., they've set up a mechanism now where if a patient has a hip fracture on the medication, the drug company pays for the cost of treating that complication. And so that's one example. Another example, Merck has some diabetes drugs where they're tying the rebate, the amount, the money that the company pays back to the health plans, to whether or not patients had good control of their diabetes as measured by their blood sugar level on an ongoing basis and whether or not they were hospitalized for certain complications. And if the idea is that the manufacturer saying, we think this drug can really be used effectively, we're going to help you do it. When the complication rates go down, we want you to pay us somewhat more. And conversely, if it doesn't go down, we'll pay you less. And as you can see, it's a really different kind of incentive for payment than we traditionally have in healthcare. And it really does, I think, a lot to align the manufacturers with the goals of patients and the goals of providers to get better care at a lower cost. The one key piece of making this work, though, is having good, reliable measures of when a treatment is having an impact on a disease. And that gets back to the point I was making about data and the point I was making about consistent measurement. Yes, go ahead, Amy. Yeah. Well, I think what you all are doing already is, so the question is, what can we do to reduce the uncertainty and the time for development and also reduce the uncertainty about reimbursement? I think a lot of things that you all are doing already with neurodegenerative diseases is making a big difference. You know, it gets back to what I was talking about earlier about if you have a better understood model for how disease progression occurs and markers for when for which patients are likely to respond to treatment and when they are responding, so you don't have to wait. You know, you don't have to enroll an enormous number of patients in the clinical trials. You don't have to wait many years to figure out if there's an actual clinical impact. That can substantially reduce the uncertainty associated with developing a new treatment. At the reimbursement stage, I think it does come down to this pressure that we face on the one hand of, look, as medical technologies become more complex and sophisticated, as we have more patients who could potentially benefit, costs tend to go up, and if we don't find a better solution to that, as we can't, we have only finite resources, what tends to happen is we end up squeezing down the prices kind of across the board, and that's not a very good, you know, in an era of what should be more personalized and targeted medicine, it's not a very good way of encouraging the really innovative treatments that could save costs elsewhere. And there, I think the key is to really make a push for measuring reliably what it is that we want these treatments to accomplish, and then helping make clear that that's going to be a basis for reimbursement, so that instead of as the costs of Alzheimer's disease go up and Medicaid programs are squeezed, the solution isn't to cut nursing home reimbursement rates by 10% across the board and to cut payments for new drugs by 10% across the board, but rather have a basis for being more selective about how we're spending the money. If there really are new treatments that are keeping people out of nursing homes and that are improving their functional status, that's going to help reduce costs elsewhere in the system, but only if we have the payment incentives to support the development of those treatments. And I think that comes back to what I was talking about earlier, being able to measure the clinical impact and putting a big emphasis on trying out and expanding the payment reforms that we're already starting to see that I think can be a big push to make this happen. I'd like to, yes, you get to ask a question too.
My question is, it seems to me that we're talking about rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. We've got a global burden of illness that far exceeds anything that we can conceive of. And yet our research is being costed as if there's no value in researching something that is going to make potentially enormous dent in the future burden of illness and the cost associated. So while we're talking all about how we're going to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic by doing this regulatory reform and development reform, when are we going to have the Congressional Budget Office and the GAO and everybody start thinking big in terms of what we're doing against the burden of illness that's coming down on us?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and as you said, in CBO scoring, spending on research shows up as an expense. It doesn't show up as in terms of its productivity impact or its impact on health, even though there is a lot of research, including some of mine, showing that, look, the returns that we're getting for the dollars we spend on research are extremely high in terms of economic benefits, in terms of health benefits that the people tremendously value. It's a hard problem for, you know, I'm sympathetic to the actuaries who are trying to do this work, because it's really hard to make the direct connection between a little bit more spending here on a particular disease and cost outcomes, you know, down the road for certain sets of patients. I do think there's a lot of promise in the kinds of directions that I talked about, because it's not just a matter of making the regulatory process more efficient through having better disease models and models of disease progression and impact, but those same models should become part of what actuaries are using to project the costs of programs. Right now, there's not really a big model other than, well, we spend another $1 billion on research, that's going to have a lot of downstream consequences, but we can't really trace that through very easily. And I think making these more connections more explicit, which is what science-based systems biology, all the omics, what this is all really supposed to be about is more confidence, more targeted and predictive models of medicine that should be able to match up better with those actuarial analyses. I think this can all fit together. Thank you all very much for the opportunity to join me today.